Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society, where we strive to be open-hearted and open-minded. If you are new here, or this is one of your first times, there will be a space later on in the service when you can introduce yourself, if you want to. If this is one of your first times here, although I don't think we have any visitors today, but we might. We always urge you to return more than once because our services are different each Sunday. You are welcome here no matter where you are on this journey of life, no matter your sexual orientation, your gender preference, your color of your hair, your abilities or disabilities, your ethnicity, you are welcome here. The National March for Our Lives Against Gun Violence takes place Saturday, March 24th, so that would be this coming Saturday. The Madison March begins at 10 a.m. at the State Street corner of the Capitol Square. Prairie members might want to march as a group. Anne,
yeah.
Do you want to just, yeah, raise your hand. Thank you. So you can talk to Anne about that. The opening words are from Sarah Alden Ripley, who writes, "The line in life, nature, science, philosophy, religion constantly returns into itself. The opposite poles become one when the circle is completed. All truth revolves about one center. All is a manifestation of one law." And Mary, if you would light the chalice, please. Thank you. We light this flame to help us find our way through the darkness to the truth. In the words of the poet Denise Levertov, "Marvelous truth, capital T, confront us at every turn, in every guise, iron ball, egg, dark horse, shadow, cloud of breath on the air. Dwell in our crowded hearts, our steaming bathrooms, kitchens full of things to be done, the ordinary streets. Thrust close your smile that we know you. Terrible joy." Thank you, Mary.
I have two short readings that I'd like to share with you. The first is from an article, a column titled, "It Took an Explosion to Wake Up News Media." And this is from Jeff Cohen and Norman Solomon's book, Adventures in Media Land, which I highly recommend. And you know you can't go wrong with a book that is in, where the introduction is done by Molly Ivins, a name a lot of you will remember. It was an amazing discovery for network TV and other national news media. Within hours of the Simi, S-I-M-I, Valley jury's acquittals in the beating of Rodney King, they unearthed millions of people living in America's desperate inner cities. What followed were rare TV specials and magazine cover stories about urban poverty and neglect. Ted Koppel even hosted a Nightline in South Central. If many Americans had been stunned by the Los Angeles riots of the early 90s, none were caught more off guard than national news outlets. That America's poor urban areas are powder kegs ready to explode had been highlighted in other mediums. You could hear it in rap music, or see it in such movies as Do the Right Thing or Boys in the Hood. But in most national news media, this reality was no big deal, despite being in the middle of an election campaign when our most pressing problems are supposed to receive a full airing. Until LA erupted, the inner city was a non-issue in campaign 92. Political journalists regularly dismiss blacks as just another selfish special interest group,
sort of like the natural gas lobby. Media pundits openly instructed candidates to ignore the concerns of blacks, Latinos, and the poor, and appeal instead to, quote, the middle class, unquote, a code phrase that began to sound like just us white folks. In fact, since 1990, many news outlets have seemed less concerned about racism than about the allegedly overzealous activists who challenge inequality. Denounced as politically correct in countless media stories. A computer search of the term politically correct conducted by FAIR analyst Steve Rendell found that the Los Angeles Times published 252 articles containing this put down in just 6 months alone. The media obsesses with disparaging activists. It has helped obscure the fact that racism, bigotry, and hate crimes are on the rise. So we do have, they go on, I'm going to skip parts of this, but they do write this. By contrast, Boston's African-American media during the same time period provided a more multifaceted story, which, while not ignoring crime, revealed a black community thirsty for educational advancement and entrepreneurial achievement, and eager to remedy poor living conditions made worse by bureaucratic neglect. You're not finding that in the mainstream press. Occasionally you would, though. Occasionally mainstream news reports deserve credit for exposing racism. In September 1991, for example, a segment on ABC's Primetime Live offered powerful proof that racial discrimination is far from a thing of the past. The program dispatched two well-dressed, university-educated types, one black, one white, to apply for jobs with the same employer, to rent apartments from the same landlord, and to buy a used car from the same dealer. ABC's hidden cameras recorded that again and again, the black man was lied to or cheated. Recent studies give the same results. And this from Unitarian Universalist Minister Kathleen McTeague, this in contrast, the common good. We breathe the common wind of the earth, no matter where we live, who we love, what language we speak. We drink the common water of the earth, no matter the color of our skin, how long we live, the coverings we drape on our forms. We follow the common paths of the earth, no matter our beliefs, how far we move from home, the gold that we carry, or its lack. May we live from these truths, our hearts open to the holiness all around us, our hands turned always toward the common good. It all started with Mr. Mone. Robert Mone, the POD teacher at Franklin High School in my senior year there. Who else had to take POD?
What is it?
Ah, that was my next question. Problems of Democracy.
No, we had civics, but
no. No, not the same. Civics was required. Civics we took in ninth grade. Now, I'm not certain anymore whether POD
I don't think civics was taught.
Anne, stop giving. Do you want to give a
sermon?
I'm going to miss you. No, I really am, but you're always a joke. Okay. I can't remember anymore if Problems of Democracy was required. It certainly should have been. And as I said, it wasn't the same thing as civics. I think we also had to take at least half a semester of Pennsylvania history. At least. I credit and occasionally blame that POD class for my becoming a news junkie. At the beginning of the semester, that senior year in high school, Mr. Mone told us that we had to read one credible newspaper every week At least one. And then, of course, we had to hand in something written. And he gave us a list of newspapers to choose from. I remember parts of this list, the obvious ones, such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the perhaps not so obvious ones, including the Boston Globe, the New Orleans Picayune, the San Francisco Chronicle, and I think the Milwaukee Journal. I'm in Pennsylvania, I'm not in Wisconsin at this point. The amazing thing to me today, well, one of the amazing things is I remember this, and I remember the name of the teacher, and But the one of the amazing things to me about that class and that list is where I went to high school. Small town, about 10,000 people, in rural northwestern Pennsylvania, only one high school, 180 in my graduating class. Where do we get the newspapers? I really can't quite remember. We did have an excellent town library, and there was an amazing newsstand downtown, where I thought my grandfather always went to smoke cigars, which he probably did, but he also went to get the latest stock market tips. So, thus began a lifetime of reading a daily newspaper. That lifetime ended on November 8th, 2016. I am gradually trying to resurrect it. I haven't gotten very far. In the Sunday New York Times, I haven't gotten much beyond travel, sports, art and entertainment, and the styles section. The styles section has an amazing amount of news, though. I mean, news that you really need to know. I'm not kidding. And of course, the book review section, but I'm not sure that counts for my purposes here. To be fair, I can't blame all of the strangeness in life on the current administration. Another factor enters into my consumption of news in this day and age, the sheer overload of information, facts, not facts, opinions that just bombard us all day, every day, 24/7, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. How can anybody possibly keep up with the continuous news cycles on cable television? More information, less news. Well, the news is brought to me these days by public radio, the BBC News, British Broadcasting, and the NewsHour on public broadcasting, and the magazines I subscribe to, primarily the New Yorker and Yes Magazine, both of which, of course, I highly recommend, and our two local weeklies, Isthmus and what remains of the Cap Times. I find myself asking whether or not I can be that guy anymore, assuming I ever was. Be that guy, that first hymn said. Be that helper, nothing daunts. Ever strive for liberty, show the path that life should go. Well, how can I be any of that without knowledge of what is going on in the world? How can I decide for the good or evil side? A line from a hymn we'll sing in a minute. How can I know that I am on the correct path towards truth, capital T, if there is such a thing, if I cannot trust the news? The news is brought to me by or through or via what sources? What and who can I believe? As I wrote in this month's Prairie Fire, our fifth principle says that we Unitarian Universalist congregations covenant to affirm and promote the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. Our democratic process is under attack. Two essential elements of a democratic society are a strong public education system and a free, dynamic, independent press. But how free is the press in this era with few surviving newspapers? How do you know if the news you consume is fake or not? Has the demise of printed newspapers and the rise of social media undermined the role of journalists in our democracy? How does the media further the common good? What is the common good? Is it the same thing as the greater good? And if not, what's the difference? Will the common or the greater good lead us to the truth, capital T? Whose job is it anyway, leading us to the truth? Well, clearly the New York Times believes that it's its job. I don't know how many of you can read this, full-page ad. Of course, it's in the Times, so it's...
Yeah. What does it say?
It says, and it's from mid-January this year, the truth has power, the truth will not be threatened, the truth has a voice.
Wow.
The only other thing on the page, just in case you forgot, is it says the New York Times. But I was impressed. I was impressed by that. If those who were reporting on the Rodney King story in 1992 had the ideal of the common good and the ideal of getting to the truth, if they had those ideals in the forefront of their minds, would the Rodney King incident have played out differently? And years later, would there have been a Ferguson, Missouri? If earlier stories about race had been told with honesty, authenticity, and integrity, and with the common good in mind, would these other things have happened? Who determines what stories matter and what ones don't? Yes, I know that editors, publishers, television executives, and so on and so forth supposedly determine what makes the news, but aren't we, as citizens, the ultimate determiners? Here's a true story about news on the internet. On Monday, January 15th of this year, Mathilde Krim, K-R-I-M, died. Do you know who she was? And you can't answer. Okay. Among other things, she was a biologist who spoke five languages. She smuggled guns to Palestinians who opposed British rule. She hosted John F. Kennedy's 45th birthday party at her house. Put a trivia for you. She received the Presidential Medal of Honor for her work in both AIDS research and as an advocate for people with that disease. And despite all of this, the internet didn't give her much attention at all. When she died, an example of internet sexism. When Joan Rivers died, according to Gina Belafonte, the internet exploded because we could talk about what kind of feminist her comedy of self-loathing made her. But all Mathilde Krim did was save thousands of lives through her AIDS research. Oh, and spending her life fighting stereotypes and stigmas about women in general and about female scientists in particular. But according to Gina Belafonte, who she writes the Big City column in the New York Times, by the next morning, the leading conversation after Krim had died, the leading conversation about among women whose voices are prominent on social media revolved around, no, not that story about the incredible woman, Mathilde Krim, and they revolved around the story of a young female photographer who had a demoralizing sexual encounter with Aziz Ansari, an encounter that woman considered to be an assault. Columnist Belafonte concludes that female narratives that invite judgments tend to draw publicity while others go ignored. Well, are they equally important news items, the sexual harassment claims and the woman who could be an important role model for countless women? Is the common good, the greater good, the beloved community, capital B, capital C, better served knowing about Mathilde Krim or about Aziz Ansari's possibly bad behavior? Or do we have to pick? Does it have to be either or? You can tell that I'm going to be leaving you with more questions than answers this morning. But as I also said in my newsletter column, I hope this will be the first of several Sunday mornings devoted to the topic of how we get our news, where we get it from. And I don't mean that the subsequent morning should be delivered by me. I'm hoping that some of you will volunteer to put together a program about how you get news. And it would be fascinating to hear from people of different ages. I'm obviously biased towards print newspapers. I know I can read most of the same thing online. And a clarifying point, the deeper I got into research on this subject, the more I realized that probably most of the sources I used, we were all using the word press when we probably meant encompassing all sources obtaining information. Newspapers, of course, but magazines, radio, television, internet. So perhaps the correct word to use is media, but I just wanted to clarify that. Now, in some important ways, there's nothing new under the sun where journalism and news gathering are concerned. Some of this won't surprise you at all, but it's still interesting. Blunders and bloopers have always been committed by those who bring us the news. Consider these headlines from an internet, I don't know, what is an internet, story? Titled, "We Must Never Let Newspapers Die." Homicide victims rarely talk to police. Miracle cure kills fifth patient. Bridges help people cross rivers. 17 remain dead in morgue shooting spree. Man accused of killing lawyer receives a new attorney. Parents keep kids home to protest school closure. So, you know, newspapers certainly haven't been perfect. What about the reporting of news related to so-called special interests? That is, what about people whose voices are either never heard or are told by those who are not part of the group that is not being heard? There aren't too many negatives there. The example, of course, is the main example is white people speaking for black people. This isn't a new concern, and it's an ongoing one for women, minorities, people of color, prisoners, immigrants, go on and on. And there are stories, people whose stories are not told accurately, not told by the people who claim the stories as their own. And then there's all the news that just didn't get reported as early as it should have. In media land, where I took that one of those readings from, Solomon and Cohen start out one essay with "The person who jolted America's news media about the AIDS crisis was not a politician, it was a movie star, Rock Hudson." Think of all the truly important news stories that could have been better reported and brought to our attention by the media much, much sooner, much earlier. I can think of so many. I still have a daughter, but she lived in Las Vegas for over 20 years. So one of the underreported or not reported stories that often comes to my mind is the dangers of testing nuclear weapons. They did it, you know, out there in the desert, not far from Las Vegas. So many environmental concerns. And then the ubiquity of domestic violence. Think of how underreported that's been. And then we always have to try to figure out how ideologically biased or partisan those people who bring us the news are. In 1979, in Newsweek, conservative columnist George Will called the movie The China Syndrome. There's a nuclear reactor accident in that movie. Will called that hysterical Hollywood propaganda, quote. He went on to say that nuclear plants like color TV sets give off minute amounts of radiation, but there is more cancer risk in sitting next to a smoker than next to a nuclear plant. That issue of Newsweek was still out on the newsstands when Three Mile Island happened in my home state of Pennsylvania. In 1986, William F. Buckley, a New York Times conservative columnist, said about AIDS, those people infected with it should be tattooed on their forearm and on their buttocks. He had to recant that after it was pointed out it sounded like Nazi propaganda, or not, well, Nazi actual doings. And lest you think that such non-objective, even irrational, certainly erroneous reporting is only done by columnists on the right, consider this. In 1989 on National Public Radio, the liberal commentator, Cokie Roberts, talked about, quote, George Bush's pro-civil rights record. 1 year later, liberal columnist Mark Shields said on PBS's McNeil Laird NewsHour, George Bush was supportive of the interests of black people and civil rights.
neither Shields nor Roberts mentioned this fact. Bush opposed the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And he would go on, Bush would, to criticize important civil rights legislation as being quota bills. Why don't those who bring us the news today give us more documentation and in-depth reporting via their websites? This is a question asked by Bruce Bartlett in a wonderful little book. The title's longer than the book. The Truth Matters, A Citizen's Guide to Separating Facts from Lies and Stopping Fake News in Its Tracks. It's this thick. It won't take you very long to read it. Bartlett writes, perhaps the biggest difference between a reputable news organization and an untrustworthy one that should be shunned is whether they correct their mistakes in a transparent way. Diligence is necessary because mistakes can take on a life of their own. And then Bartlett gives his favorite example of this, which I have to share with you because it's a Unitarian story. In 1917, H.L. Mencken, a famous essayist, wrote an article about then-President Millard Fillmore, who was a Unitarian, although we generally don't claim him. Mencken wrote this article and in which he said that Fillmore put in the first ever bathtub in the White House. And some of you are shaking your heads, oh, I knew that. I have even said that from up here in a reading. This event, Mencken said, should be remembered every year on its anniversary date. Mencken made this up. It was supposed to be satire. And yet, years later, it's still out there as the truth. Well, Mencken was apparently appalled by this, and he tried to correct the error, admitting to making it all up, but he failed. The fact that Fillmore installed the first White House bathtub has become common knowledge. Yes. Which brings us to fake news. Bartlett says that this problem of mistakes taking on a life of their own and how important it is to correct mistakes immediately has gotten much worse in the internet era for at least two reasons. One is how quickly an error or fake false news can travel. And secondly, the proliferation of satirical websites and the propensity of people to use sarcasm as a way of putting down political opponents. Fake news is not new. It's not a new concept. There has no doubt been a greater output of fake news since the last presidential election. But false reporting is nothing new. Ben Franklin, he was particularly good at this. When he was our country's brand new ambassador in France and England and over there in Europe, he published a counterfeit newspaper whose purpose was to mislead the British and persuade them to be sympathetic to the new Republic of America. Fake news since the turn of the century, and of course I mean the 20th into the 21st, fake news in our current times, most of you may know this, became popular during George W. Bush's presidency when John Stewart would supposedly quote progressives on the subject of his, Bush's administration. Fake news is, after all, to use Bartlett's word, or no, this is a New York Times quote, fake news is just political satire packaged as information. And the Times said that well over a decade ago. For any number of reasons, though, we don't want fake news mucking up the political process. Well, fake news might not be new, but the techniques used to get it spread around are certainly new, thanks to the internet and social media. It's easy to put lies out there and then promote those lies. But you would think and you would hope that the truth would win out for those very reasons, that it's easy to get information out there and get it out quickly and keep reinforcing it. But there's some discouraging news in this area. Bruce Bartlett reports that political scientists have found that when people have been exposed to lies, are then confronted with the truth, they often believe the lie even more strongly. For some reason, the more a lie is repeated, the more credible it becomes. And of course, confirmation bias comes into this. People believe what they want to believe. The importance of this cannot be overstated. But we can be successful in the struggle against fake news. We have to keep in mind that fake news that is interesting or titillating people are going to like that. But they're also going to like the new fake news, any news, that confirms a core belief. And always remember Molly Ivins. For those of you who don't know who she was, unfortunately she's not with us. She was a reporter, a commentator, a journalist, a writer from Texas. And here's her favorite phrase, follow the money. As Bruce Bartlett says in his little wee book, clicks on our keyboards. Clicks equal advertising dollars. So think before clicking. And if you are wondering about the truthfulness or the truthiness, Colbert, I think, said that. Bartlett tells us to be, I love this phrase, skeptical and agnostic, especially if the news item confirms something you want to believe. So who's calling the shots? Who's out there saying the emperor has no clothes? Who are the gatekeepers now that the reporters and the journalists are not able or willing to perform that duty as often as maybe they did in the past? And if you don't think gatekeepers are important, think about this. What if there had been effective, strong, courageous gatekeepers among the press in between the two world wars as Hitler was coming to power? And then stop a minute and think about what the Nazis did with language in those years. Very clever. What if there had been responsible gatekeepers in the 1950s in this country? Responsible gatekeepers who would have called Senator Joe McCarthy out and exclaimed that the emperor has no clothes. Here's a quiz. Who's being described in this quote? His actions have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Well, not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, lies not in our stars, but in ourselves. To whom is this referring? Could be Trump. McCarthy. Joe McCarthy. If you don't know who that is, please look it up.
From Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, we try not to talk too much about that one. There are reasons to be hopeful about who brings us our news. We learn things on our own. We learn the truth often through our own observation and common sense. There are things that I believe, whether or not official sources of news have told me that I should believe them. A great current example is I believe that many young people throughout this country marched this past Wednesday, March 14th. I didn't even have to see all the pictures. And for some reasons that I can't explain, though might be related to my background in history and international relations, I knew instinctively that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now, if I knew that, and I suppose this intuitiveness of mine in this instance could also be attributed to the kind of skepticism nurtured in me during the Vietnam War. But we can be hopeful because we know how to fix the problem. It comes down to discernment, to critical thinking, to the never-ending search for the truth, capital T. We can be hopeful because there are reporters, journalists, commentators willing to say the emperor has no clothes. Commentators like Joy Ann Reid on MSNBC, who has been called a heroine of the resistance to Trump's administration. Ms. Reid says that we are all guilty of skimming the articles or reading the headlines, and she was apologizing for having done exactly that before firing off, yes, a tweet. She admits to having that in common with Trump. Firing off a tweet to a conservative writer without first carefully considering her response. Under the current administration in the United States, fake news has been dangerously redefined. Reid maintains, now something is true because you like it. If the information is displeasing to you, or makes you uncomfortable, or is in opposition to your ideology, then it is fake, which she puts in quotes. She continues, people don't just want to disagree with the people they disagree with, they want to destroy them. Knowledge is power. Reid is worried about something I think we all worry about, that those of us consuming the news will put ourselves into a place of isolation and consciously or unconsciously opt to believe only that which makes us feel good. I'm guilty of that. I know that I should at least try to read, listen to, watch sources of news that come from people I probably don't agree with. My mute button is wearing out on my remote because there are certain voices I can't listen to. So how often do I actually do this? Not push the mute button, but try to listen to the other side. Hardly ever. How can I broaden my information gathering more calmly and perhaps more rationally? Well, you might say to me, yes, but hasn't this always been the case? Haven't people always tended to gather information about the world from sources that make them feel good? Good, comfortable, safe. Well, probably. But it seems to me there's a difference now here in the 21st century. And different because of things I've already mentioned, like the internet and social media, but different in a more crucial, critical way. I think that it is more acceptable now, if that makes any sense, more acceptable to only seek out information that confirms what you already believe. And thus we come full circle. We are back to Mr. Mooney's Problems of Democracy class and the importance of critical thinking, as well as the importance of having a robust public school system. Teach critical thinking everywhere, in all classes and curricula, from kindergarten on. Don't make it this separate entity over here, as if it weren't really that important. Teach it everywhere. Turn the methods used by the purveyors of fake news back on them. That can be as simple as checking to see if others are reporting a story that seems too good to be true. And don't fall for the "it's just entertainment" argument. As Bruce Bartlett learned, unfortunately, some very important people, quote, anchors or cable news channels, widely syndicated talk radio hosts and the like, use entertainment as an excuse to peddle lies. Because they can then say, when they're called out on this, oh, well, they're mainly entertainers. They're not journalists. We can be hopeful because we still have our sense of humor, and there is always a place for humor. I think I should end with just a few more headlines. Humor can serve to remind us that the good old days of printed newspapers and responsible journalism had its problems too and its blind spots. Think seriously, a serious example is how underrepresented so many groups were in the good old days. So let's end with these headlines. Federal agents raid gun shop, find weapons. Total lunar eclipse will be broadcast live on Northwoods Public Radio. Meeting on open meetings is closed. Statistics show that teen pregnancy drops off significantly after age 25. New sick policy requires 2-day notice. And one of my favorites, marijuana issue sent to a joint committee.
A lot of the research says that the fake news came out of satire. Well, I guess that still is true. So thank you for that. And it won't surprise you that I ran across references to The Onion all over the place, a lot, in all the research I did. Closing words are by Unitarian Universalist Minister Laura Lynn Bellamy. If here you have found freedom, take it with you into the world. If you have found comfort, go and share it with others. If you have dreamed dreams, help one another that they may come true. And if you have known love, give some back to a bruised and hurting world. Go in peace, eat soup and salad, greet your neighbors.